I want to talk a bit about puzzles today, including one that I explore but do not claim to solve in my new book, and to talk about origin stories and how they shape what we say about history and about ourselves. If you like a tidy story, this is not good news. But I hope it will at least give a small glimpse of the great pleasure that writing Untidy Origins was. I'd like to tell you how I came to write this book, itself an untidy and long process. That, like all scholarly work, says something about me, as well as about the historical conversations it engages in. I like to unravel things. I've always been intrigued by what is out of the question, and then tempted to see what happens if we ask it anyway. So, for example, many years ago, when I was writing about women's benevolent and reform work, I tried to pull apart some threads in a neat historical analysis of the ideology of women's sphere and women's greater moral superiority, meshing perfectly with women's work for reform and charitable causes. I like to poke at things, intellectually speaking, and see what lies underneath, and try to figure out why things remain or are kept invisible. Apparently, I asked why at a young age, and really, I haven't stopped. In my own work on the history of women, I tend to ask why and how ideologies about gender obscure other historical realities, and how the common sense assumptions that of American life shape, contain, and control radical ideas. After writing about mainstream ideas and so-called dominant cultures, I turned to the fringes of American political culture and explored questions about women and free thought, free thinkers, that small cadre of anti-clerical activists whose appeals to reason so distressed ministers and writers. I became interested in how the language of sexual deviance and religious infidelity was used to define the boundaries of acceptable thought, how attacks against women as irreligious could so often and so effectively replace any actual argument against their demands or concerns. When I started what became Untidy Origins, I thought I was writing a book about those limits and their impact on women's political identities, about how attacks against women's equality forced some women to defend their own sexual and religious respectability, and in the long term, forced them to make certain compromises in their demands. Looking at the rhetoric about the ways women belonged to the nation, I began to focus closely on the insistence by antebellum politicians, but also by women's historians, that any mention of women's political equality before the late 1840s was not just bad or unworkable or new or scary, but was unthinkable, and what it meant to advocates of social change to enter that kind of intellectual turf. Digging through constitutional convention debates, court records, and political tracts, I kept bumping into something unexpected. For many of the men engaged in shaping the boundaries of full membership in political life, women's suffrage was not so much impossible to contemplate as it was the very embodiment of a slippery slope. They spent an inordinate amount of time insisting that the idea of women as full citizens was outside the boundaries of legitimate discussion, too dangerous even to contemplate, a pernicious heresy, as one politician put it in 1872. No one, these men insisted, could consider women's political equality, and politicians declared themselves quite certain that no one ever would. I've written about this rhetoric in Untidy Origins and elsewhere, and I don't want to go into it at length today. Let me just say that I came to predict with terrific accuracy that soon after venting about the impossibility of granting black men the vote, or the dangers of giving suffrage to white men without property, or the threats posed by expanding some property right, some man would declare, with an air of closure, "But if we grant that right, it will open the door to women voting, and obviously none of us can imagine that," and all the men in the hall nod. Let me offer a small sense of how this sounded. When he advocated expanding the vote to all white men, Alexander Campbell, a delegate to the 1829 Virginia Constitutional Convention, explained to his fellow delegates that, quote, "A citizen is a freeman who has a voice in the government under which he lives. No disfranchised man is a citizen. He may be an inhabitant, alien, or what you please, but without a vote, he cannot be a citizen." "This was ridiculous," retorted Benjamin Lee. Quote, "It is not a necessary qualification of a citizen that he should be entitled to vote. If it were, it would be most absurd to exclude from the privilege of citizenship every female and every minor in the community." Similarly, in the Constitutional Convention that took place in this city in 1846, delegates who were debating restrictions on African American men's suffrage used the absurdity of women's full citizenship to close debate. "Wherefore the qualification of 21 years of age?" cried Horatio Stowe sarcastically. "Wherefore the qualification of male citizenship? Why not allow it to all of both sexes and all conditions and ages, whether alien or citizen, if it was a matter of absolute right?" The fear that opening the door to more citizens with full political rights would make it harder to close on others was not a new creation. When future Massachusetts Supreme Court Justice John Sullivan in the late 18th century mused about the nature of rights in politics, as people of the Revolutionary era were prone to do, wondered whence arises the right of the men to govern women without their consent. His friend John Adams begged him to keep such thoughts to himself. "It is dangerous to open so fruitful a source of controversy and altercation," Adams warned nervously. "There will be no end of it. New claims will arise. Women will demand a vote." There will be no end of it. This reminds me of a button I have hanging up in my office that says, "If gay and lesbian people are given civil rights, then everyone will want them." As everyone who participated in conversations about rights and belonging knew, talk is cheap, but ideas are dangerous things. Taken to their extreme, the most frightened among these men declared, ideas could threaten the laws not only of the state, but of God and nature. Politicians could only prevent that frightening possibility, apparently, by expressing satisfaction that such ideas were out of the question. But as I listened in on this 19th century conversation among men who complacently accepted their right to define as well as answer the questions at hand, I got bored. For one thing, I dislike history that takes place in settings where only white men get to speak. It's not what I do. For another, I kept feeling that I didn't have a story here. Something bothered me about the core of my project, about the argument I was beginning to make that no one could imagine demanding women's rights because of the very power of rhetoric that declared such a demand unchristian, unwomanly, and un-American. So I was walking from the New York Public Library one day to meet a friend when it hit me that I did have the story, but that it went against the one that I thought I was telling. At that moment, I began to imagine a book that wove together two narratives, two opposing stories about the possibility of women's rights. The kind of intellectual, social, and political history that this idea promised sounded just about tangled up enough for me. What I realized that day was that I already knew that the idea of women's full and equal rights was not out of the question, because the question had been raised. Several years earlier, slogging through the debates of the 1846 Constitutional Convention in New York, I had stumbled upon this story. Here it is. In August 1846, a delegate to the convention, Alpheus S. Green, a Democrat from Watertown, presented a petition from six ladies of Jefferson County. The petition asserted that, quote, "the present government of this state has widely departed from the true democratic principles upon which all just governments must be based by denying the female portion of community the right of suffrage and any participation in forming the government and laws under which they live. There is no deference in this petition. The women did not adopt the stance of supplicants, or quasi-citizens, or mothers, or, for that matter, of ladies. On the contrary, they simply confronted their exclusion as full citizens and objected to it. Intriguingly, the women claimed that their demand for women's equal and civil and political rights with men involved, as they put it, no new right, but only those which have been ungenerously withheld from us. Further, they refused to debate the issue, confident that, in their words, a self-evident truth is sufficiently plain without argument. It is literally a stunning document. There are so many stories of which these words could be a part, so many questions they raise. There is much that is odd about their petition, not least that the women wrote it at all. Also, that it was printed in the Constitutional Convention debates was peculiar. Virtually every other petition to the convention was simply noted as having been presented, but there's no text or list of names attached. It doesn't appear in most accounts of the emergence of women's rights in America, in part because of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony's extraordinary ability to shape the history of the movement they led. Also peculiar is the petition's utter absence from Franklin Huff's exhaustive History of Jefferson County, published in 1854, for which the author visited every town, eagerly seeking out and recording indications of scandalous or unusual behavior. Apparently, the women's petition was noteworthy as neither. So, keeping in mind my dual narrative about women's rights, I started untangling. One puzzle that I sought to answer was about where the women came from, literally, the social history piece, if you like. The women who wrote and signed this petition, Eleanor Vincent, Lydia Williams, Lydia Osborne, Susan Ormsby, Amy Ormsby, and Anna Bishop, have remained virtually invisible to history and were impressively resistant to my searching out their stories. Ordinary middle-aged farm wives, for the most part, they were linked by blood, marriage, and friendship. Most had lived for decades on adjoining or nearby farms in the DePauville section of Clayton. Theirs were not among the town's leading families, nor were they well connected politically. They appear in no accounts of reform struggles. None attended the Seneca Falls Convention 2 years later, and none is mentioned in Stanton and Anthony's History of Woman Suffrage. And yet they challenge what we thought we knew about women's political identities before 1848. Six women in Jefferson County, New York, did not find the idea of women's full rights unthinkable or unacceptable or, I think, so very radical, and they said so. To some degree, theirs is a story about Jefferson County itself. Clayton was a newly settled and highly contentious place in the far north on the Canadian border, shaped by a legacy of shady land deals, border disputes, bankruptcies, and greedy speculators. Questions about land titles and property ownership were central to the women and men who settled there. It was, and they were, on the nation's margins. Maps and surveys of population, of churches, of roads, and of other measures of human habitation before 1860 or so often just leave out the county. References to its towns and institutions are as scattered as its people. Travelers rarely describe Jefferson County, although they do note the fine harbors on the St. Lawrence River and Lake Ontario. One writer greatly underestimated the matter when he referred to Watertown, Jefferson County's largest city, as off the main tourist route. And still today, when people hear about my book, they say, oh yes, I've been to Seneca Falls, which is 125 miles away. Indeed, as late as the War of 1812, people in northern New York described those in New York City and Philadelphia as living in the States. Even the markers of change in Jefferson County differ from the standard narrative. Take the Erie Canal, which historians associate with religious fervor and cheap Western wheat. For Jefferson County, long fortunate in its waterways, the canal signaled, as one historian put it, a 500-mile funeral procession for its economic hopes. A troubled place, it was where some women, in the face of much talk to the contrary, declared themselves partners in founding the social compact under which they lived. On the face of it, this doesn't seem a likely place to encourage the idea that women's rights were too obvious to debate. So, seeking to investigate the history of their ideas, not in convention halls, but in the lives of actual people, I dug into events that touched this community, looking for clues to what caused them to storm over to a sister's farm to share their ideas with like-minded friends. I tried to keep an eye on the question my own sister asked me when I was getting caught up in the minutiae of this story: what was going on up there? But in this place, the conversations about citizenship, belonging, and rights have been difficult to overhear. Of course, like other American historians looking for women's rights talk, I looked for anti-slavery activism, but there is barely a whisper from Jefferson County in abolitionist newspapers or organizations. Knowing that New Yorkers were notoriously partisan and that Jefferson County farmers adhered mostly to the Democratic Party and had free soil or barn burner leanings, I followed the conversation about the rights of citizens into the chaos of the state's political life. I don't actually recommend doing that if you can help it. I was not terribly surprised to find that these women were part of a community that was deeply interested in and committed to expanding the rights of citizenship to include slaves, free African Americans, and women. Tracking down these clues was an adventure, and I'm certainly not going to tell you all the things I found, though I assure you many of them are merely glimpses. One of my favorites, however, is in a will, and it shows pretty well how the hunting went. Susan Ormsby, the only one of the petition signers to remain unmarried, had, I knew, inherited a farm from her unmarried brother, Bailey, in 1848. He died in 1848. In his will, Bailey made Susan one of two executors. The other person Bailey appointed to the role of responsibility implying closeness and certainly trust was Hugh Smith, I'd never heard of Hugh Smith, and really had little reason to think he mattered to my story, until I ran across him again, running for office on a Liberty Party ticket, making his home on Perch River a local center of anti-slavery activism, and, as one local chronicler puts it, becoming well known for his decided stand for the abolition of slavery, for temperance, and for morality. Given the tendency of abolition principles to run in families, it was then a matter of time and luck until I traced Bailey Ormsby, some of the other men, and by extension their wives and sisters, to the anti-slavery and Liberty Party cause. These clues about the ties among women and men who worked and lived together and shared common principles offer the possibility that once we get past the assumption that respectable women avoided all mention of women's rights, past all the noise that declared women's full citizenship unthinkable, we must consider the possibility that such talk was widespread. And it may be through acts like theirs, communal acts, steps taken as a group of sisters, sisters-in-law, and friends, that we can peek into the process by which something declared unthinkable becomes quite thinkable indeed. At the very least, this petition underscores that several overlapping conversations were taking place in the summer of 1846, conversations that concerned the privileges of citizenship, the relationship of property to rights, and the meaning of full membership in the state and nation. Untidy origins moves between discussions that occurred in state assembly rooms and those in farmhouse kitchens. By being attentive to a small group of people who considered themselves entitled to speak in both. Rather than offering a single argument, it tries to rethink political culture while keeping the global and the local, so to speak, in one frame. However much we learn from abstract arguments about nations and political identity, it is the local itself that gives meaning to the Jefferson County petitioner's story. Although they called upon a national rhetoric of rights, they said all governments must derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, the petitioners did not appeal to a national audience. They didn't blame the federal government for having, quote, widely departed from the true democratic principles that they endorsed, or hold it responsible for having ungenerously withheld their rights. Rather, they spoke directly to the government of their state, and particularly to the men assembled to rewrite its constitution, for those rights which they, as citizens of the state of New York, may reasonably and rightfully claim. Investigations into nation building and definitions of citizenship that focus only on national rights can miss the very personal nature of these women's sense of belonging. That assumption of membership, when contrasted with their unequal status as citizens, underscored these women's conviction that their opinions mattered and that they were entitled to act. What does all this have to do with feminist origin stories, which I promised to discuss? The Jefferson County women's sense of membership in the political community, along with the contrary insistence on the unthinkableness of women's political rights, forces us to reflect again on the nearly mythic and very tidy story about women's rights that is still told in many high school textbooks and public television documentaries. It is, as all good stories are, simple and dramatic, and to our pleasure, it too happened in New York, about 180 miles from here. It has a neat beginning and a triumphant and, it now seems, inevitable end. It's the story that Americans like best to tell about ourselves, that we just keep getting better and smarter and more inclusive, and that our progress toward justice and equality just doesn't stumble. That story, of course, begins in the summer of 1848 in Elizabeth McClintock's parlor in Seneca Falls, when five women gathered for tea and conversation. Drawn by Elizabeth Cady Stanton into a passionate conversation about women's rights, they decided to call a convention to be held 2 weeks later that would demand, in the words of their Declaration of Sentiments, a thorough education, profitable employments, self-respect, and the vote. It was there, the story goes, that several hundred people, all abolitionists and many of them Quakers, first demanded woman suffrage, an idea that had been too shocking to consider just before, or, if we are to believe Stanton, that people withdrew their names from the Declaration right afterward, still too shocking to think about after. And yet, virtually overnight, and without much premeditation or preparation, a movement was launched that made the vote for women, full inclusion in the political workings of the nation, at the center of its demands. I know I'm not alone when I say that I love that story, which has been told with nuance and complexity, most recently by Judy Wellman in her new book, The Road to Seneca Falls. It has drama, it has colorful characters, it has passion, And it stresses many of those aspects of American society that we still, for all our critiques and claims to intellectual sophistication, like most, the story of progress and inclusion, and resistance by bad guys who seem to have vanished with another century because we can hardly any longer find someone who opposes women's suffrage. But in spite of the pleasures of a story where one day a small band of women see the light and raise an utterly new demand, I want to urge us all to think and talk about the feminism that it reflects. Most of the people who have written women's history over the last 30 or so years can relate to the Seneca Falls story on several levels. Most of us, you won't be surprised to learn, are women, largely from the middle and professional classes, mostly white, and many from or educated in the Northeast. Many came of age with the feminist movement, and so can relate to the powerful experience of discovering a way to articulate our anger at the contrast between our country's claims to equality and its reality. Those who married and had children identified with the story of the young, well, she was 33, she seems young to me now, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, because it's not hard to imagine being bored as a provincial housewife and mother of three active boys living in a small town after Boston with a husband who is often away because of his involvement in, imagine the envy, politics. Privileged enough to have servants to do the dirtiest work with a father who, until he got really angry at her outspokenness, subsidized her household's comforts, Stanton's busy life teemed with her burning desire to do something. She longed desperately to be, as the phrase goes, part of the passion and action of her time. But this identification with Stanton has its limits, as historians who have long criticized Stanton's racism and elitism have noted. The iconic story of Stanton's feminism tends to assume, as frankly Stanton assumed, that the kind of feminism that emerged from her frustrations and intellectual combustions was the only possible one. But when Stanton drew on the sacred political text of the Declaration of Independence in drafting the Seneca Falls Declaration, she outlined a feminism that spoke most directly to the experiences of the women who attended, and indirectly to many of their descendants who would write about it. It spoke of and to women's personal discontent and described individual rights, the right to own property, to gain an education, and to vote, as group achievements. Though some historians, notably Elsa Barkley Brown in her provocative essay about freed women's political involvement in Reconstruction-era Richmond, have urged us to rethink the vote itself as a community rather than merely as an individual possession, the story of feminism continues to be told largely in terms of individual dissatisfaction with prescribed roles and a battle for personal autonomy and individual rights. And it underscores a sometimes blind adherence to words like freedom and independence and choice, as if these words described not so much what we believe about ourselves, but our very difference from and superiority to everyone else. Elizabeth Cady Stanton helped shape a feminism from which every one of us here has benefited. Brilliant, self-confident, domineering, maternal, exasperating, impatient, ambitious, inspiring, and inconsistent, Stanton addressed the central founding principles of both American political life and American radicalism: the meaning of citizenship and equality, the relationship between intimate life and the state, and the place of Protestantism in both expanding and restricting opportunities for some American women. In both her appeal to universalism and in her particular elitism, she exemplifies many of the paradoxes in American thought, social reform, and feminism. Stanton sought to be the very model of the modern female citizen, the independent self amidst a complicated network of domestic and civic responsibilities that she spent a lifetime imagining. For Stanton, it was the individual self, more than her own place in a large or even a small community of women who shared names and lives and daily work, that underscored her grievances. Hers was a feminism that helped redefine the self as much as it did the nation, that spoke of individual longings and fulfillment more than it did about one's membership in or even commitment to something larger. She talked and talked beautifully about independence, about outrage, about personal growth in ways that I think may have seemed alien to the Jefferson County women, who felt already that they belonged, that they had helped build their farms and communities, and that as a result, they had a voice in its future. And I think it's possible, this is a tangent, but I think it's possible that this emphasis on the self and on solitude, on personal fulfillment, may be a tiny piece of why so many more contemporary American women have rejected feminism even as they've embraced rights. Certainly, Stanton's thought exemplified the radical potential of the liberal ideals that lay at the core of this nation's ideals, and I have no intention of dismissing her importance. But her analysis, like all analyses, was highly specific to her class and background. And unlike some radical intellectuals, she seems not to have made the leap to exploring how that context shaped and confined her own ideas. In particular, Stanton failed or chose not to investigate closely the class and cultural context for her own profound belief that the individual, given the opportunity, had the power to make, remake, and save herself. In this sense, Stanton represented both the strengths and the limitations of her milieu. These assumptions, deeply Protestant in nature, upper class in background, Northeastern in location, and centered primarily on the educated individual, continue to be reflected in our understanding of rights, of the relationship between the individual and the community, and in our too common complacency that individual women's advancement guarantees or reflects a more just society for all. When six Jefferson County women demanded equal and civil and political rights with men, they challenged the common sense belief that men's rule was natural, normal, and just, even as they offered evidence that some women considered themselves members with standing in local political life. The very evidence of the petition points to an ongoing discourse that has ebbed and flowed through the nation's history, forcing, at some moments, even the most politically and religiously orthodox to defend what they desperately wish would just be considered a given. However much these folks' demand for silence about women's rights failed, they continue to shape the boundaries of discussion in ways that affect efforts at social change still. Certainly they would shape the 70-year struggle for suffrage, as the advocates of women's suffrage increasingly stressed their maternity, their religious faith, their acceptance of white supremacy, and their upper-class credentials. We have not, in the process of expanding democratic rights and duties to women, entirely abandoned the notion that people must defend their own respectability in order to make claims on those in power. In Untidy Origins, I make this concrete by talking about a political debate that is currently underway, and I'll just mention it here to provoke thought and maybe some argument. I believe the current discussion about same-sex marriage resembles an older debate about women's rights, and that it too is far more complex than a triumphalist telling in a few years, or some number of years, will have it. I don't want to be misunderstood here. I think that expanding rights and privileges granted by the state to its citizens is a good thing. But those of us who advocate legalizing same-sex marriage are engaged in a conversation that both expands rights to more citizens and that continues 19th century habits of thinking about civic belonging in terms of religious and sexual morality. We don't think we're talking about virtue, per se, but we willingly inscribe rights themselves in terms of a new domesticity, virtuous adulthood defined as coupledom and parenthood. Just as Protestantism helped describe the boundaries of women's political respectability in the 19th century, so the defense of same-sex marriage can slide into invoking sexual or domestic respectability, marriage itself, as a criterion for people's full rights in the nation. The conversations that took place in upstate New York in the 1840s were, like so many conversations taking place today, about belonging, about who is us, about what obligations we have to other members of our community and our nation, and about why some people's rights seem to depend so heavily on denying them to others. The questions these struggles raise certainly aren't simple, and the answers may not be tidy, but to the extent that we continue to engage in intellectual and historical and political battles over rights and justice, and about whose rights and whose lives matter, they compel us to keep on untangling the threads. Thank you.